He testified, even though he didn't. But it's unlikely, frankly, from a criminal defense perspective, it's unlikely that he's going to get on that witness stand.
We're not going to see any of this.
No, there was a brief period of time, a couple of years in the 1990s, where we had cameras in the New York State courtrooms. Most people thought it was a fantastic success, and it helped legitimize the system. Most famously, the Amadou Diallo trial, for those who remember, was televised live. Everybody could see what happened. The powers that be decided that should not be renewed, except for pretrial performances, as it were. So we're not going to see the trial.
Can someone convicted of a felony become president?
Absolutely. There's no bar to becoming president of the United States if you're convicted of a felon. However, you cannot own a firearm. So at least if he gets elected, he won't be able to have a gun. He'll have the United States military, but not a gun.
And you have to be born in the United States.
Yes.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Ron Kuby, longtime criminal defense and civil rights lawyer here in New York. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for our digital fellowship. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Taracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Jarena Nandura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, Ravi Karen, Hani Massoud, Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randall, Paul Powell, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, and Dennis Moynihan.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kbu.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is hosting a two-hour live panel discussion this upcoming Earth Day, April 22nd, airing from 2 to 4 in the afternoon. Our panel is titled State of Oregon's Environment 2024. KBOO is organizing the event and the panelists. We will have 5 to 6 folks from different environmental issue disciplines. Each panelist will speak to their work and then be available for a Q&A session by phone with our KBOO audience. Again, this upcoming Earth Day, April 22nd, 2 to 4 p.m., tune in for our live panel, State of Oregon's Environment 2024. Our air room phone lines will be open by the end of the panel, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Support for this program comes from KBOO members and Earth and Spirit Council, presenting the world premiere of their documentary film, The Power of Ceremony, Earth Teachings for Future Generations, on Sunday, April 21st at 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. Tickets and information at earthandspirit.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Multnomah County DA candidate Nathan Vasquez faces an ethics complaint.
Pro-Palestine protesters in Eugene shut down I-5 for 2 hours.
And in national news, the Supreme Court allows an Idaho ban on gender-affirming care to go into effect while a lawsuit proceeds.
Good evening. This is KBOO Evening News from Monday, April 15th, 2024. I'm Danny Shy.
And I'm Reed Johnson. A candidate for Multnomah County District Attorney is being accused of ethics violations for publicly accusing a man of being a serial killer. defense attorneys of Jesse Lee Calhoun filed complaints with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office last month. They say Multnomah County DA candidate Nathan Vasquez made the accusations despite Calhoun never being formally charged with the crime nor convicted in a court of law. Vasquez's accusation appears in a statement attributed to, quote, Nathan in the Oregon Voter's Guide. The statement criticizes Vasquez's current boss and opponent, Multnomah County DA Mike Schmitz. Nathan writes, quote, under my opponent's watch, a violent criminal who was arrested for kidnapping and assaulting a police officer was released from prison. Once free, he murdered four women. This is unacceptable, end quote. While Vasquez did not name the supposed killer, he confirmed to OPB he was referring to Calhoun with a comment. Calhoun was one of 40 people whose sentences were commuted by Governor Kate Brown to fight the 2020 wildfires. Calhoun had less than a year left to serve on a sentence for unauthorized use of a vehicle, having previously finished sentences for assault on a public safety officer and burglary. Vasquez's statement in the Voter's Guide also prompted Lewis and Clark Law School professor Aliza Kaplan to file an Oregon State Bar Ethics complaint against the DA candidate. In her complaint, Kaplan wrote of Vasquez, quote, his actions not only undermine the public's trust in the legal profession, but also jeopardize the fairness and integrity of the judicial process, especially when viewed in the light of his current and desired prosecutorial authority, end quote. Vasquez has confirmed and defended his remarks in the Voter's Guide. He blames the controversy on DA Mike Schmidt and calls the statement with his accusation a, quote, obscure online find.
Pro-Palestine protesters shut down Interstate 5 in Eugene for 2 hours this morning. 52 demonstrators were arrested, and most were charged with disorderly conduct. The demonstration was part of a nationwide action on Monday in solidarity with Palestinians under Israel fire in Gaza. Traffic blocking protests in San Francisco shut down the Golden Gate Bridge, and another shut down access for the road at SeaTac Airport. Ports in Australia were also temporarily closed by protesters on the day of action. Demonstrators are calling on the Biden administration to stop supplying arms to Israel and to end the taxpayer-funded seize on Gaza.
The U.S. Supreme Court is allowing Idaho's ban on gender-affirming care for transgender youth to proceed while a lawsuit against the ban goes forward. That reversed a lower court decision, which had put the law on hold. The Idaho law would punish doctors with up to 10 years in prison if they provide hormones, puberty blockers, or other types of gender-affirming care to people under 18. The two trans teens who sued to stop the law would still be allowed to get care under the Supreme Court's order. Opponents of the law say it will likely increase the suicide rate among teens because of the important role that gender-affirming care has in alleviating gender dysphoria. That's what medical professionals define as severe psychological distress that is experienced by people whose gender identity is different than their sex that was assigned at birth. Every major medical organization supports gender-affirming care for youth, including the American Medical Association and the American Academy of Pediatrics. The law's backers have said they want to, quote, protect children from getting gender-affirming surgery, but there's little evidence that any of those types of surgeries are being done on transgender youth in Idaho. Idaho is among 23 U.S. states that restricts or bans gender-affirming medical care for minors.
Oregon is participating in federal food benefits program for children called Summer EBT. Dollars from the program will go even farther to purchase produce through the Double Up Food Bucks program. The Oregon legislature approved the state's participation in Summer EBT program, making nearly 300,000 children eligible to receive $40 for food each month over the summer. Mason Duffery with Oregon Food Bank says the additional benefits can be used for the Double Up Food Bucks program.
Essentially, that increases their total monthly budget that they have. But also, what's really cool about Summer EBT is any of the Summer EBT benefits can also be used to earn Double Up because they're just being treated as additional SNAP dollars on someone's card.
The Double Up Food Bucks program allows participants with benefits through the Supplemental Food Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, to buy fresh produce and have the dollars they spend matched, essentially doubling their purchasing power. Double Up Food Bucks coordinator with Oregon Food Bank, Jazz Eppelsheimer, says the program is available at a variety of venues across the state.
The benefits at participating farmers markets are amazing, grocery stores, and CSA, community supported agriculture farms, so shoppers can bring home just a lot more fresh produce.
The program matches up to $20 of purchases per day at participating farmers markets. At participating grocery stores, up to $20 spent on fruits and vegetables can be redeemed for produce on the next visit. The program can also go towards CSA membership. Oregonians can find participating organizations at doubleuporegon.org.
A new report dives into election official turnover during more than two decades. It says rates have increased steadily nationwide since 2000, with the highest level in 2022. Washington State has seen lower rates of turnover than many states, increasing from 23% in 2004 to 33% in 2022. This according to the Bipartisan Policy Center. Rachel Ori with the organization says election officials have increasingly complex jobs alongside the day-to-day logistics, likely driving turnover.
Today, election officials must manage everything from cybersecurity risks posed by foreign adversaries to public communications with people who are doubting the outcome of elections to information technology, legal disputes, political pressures, human resources. The list goes on.
While Washington has seen lower turnover rates than other states, the West is projected to have the highest turnover of any region in 2024, with a rate of nearly 42%. Ori says recent increases have occurred in larger jurisdictions, which have received the brunt of scrutiny in the wake of the 2020 election. She says increasing workloads for election officials have coincided with the widespread reports of threats and harassment that are making election administration into untenable work.
That's where state and federal legislators can really step in to provide adequate resources, competitive compensation levels, and safety protections for election officials.
However, turnover doesn't necessarily mean the people taking over are inexperienced. Ori says new officials have an average of 8 years of experience in top-level positions.
So when we see a turnover in a chief election official, it isn't always the case that someone new is coming in who doesn't know what they're doing. Rather, we see more often that it is folks with lots of experience in elections who are stepping into these chief roles.
That was Rachel Ori with the Bipartisan Policy Center.
House Republicans want citizenship proof for federal election voting. Under White House pressure, Israel shows restraint after Iran's attack. And Trump's hush money trial starts. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Our bill will establish new safeguards. It'll put us on par, by the way, with virtually every other democracy around the world. It also prohibits non-citizen voting.
Speaker of the House Mike Johnson says his conference backs legislation to require proof of citizenship to vote in federal elections. It's already illegal for non-citizens to cast those ballots, and it almost never happens, although some jurisdictions do allow it in local races. Johnson is repeating the conspiracy theory that the Biden administration is letting in millions of migrants to tip the election to Democrats. After Iran's attacks, Johnson says the House will vote on long-delayed aid for Israel. It's not clear if Johnson would let aid for Ukraine be included. The embattled speaker faces a possible rebellion from hard-right lawmakers over that. But Republican House Foreign Affairs Chair Mike McCaul says the countries face the same threats.
These rockets and these drones are being bought by Russia, and they're killing Ukrainians every day. What happened in Israel last night happens in Ukraine every night.
Under pressure from a White House concerned about a wider war, Israel has put off striking back. Israel and its allies shot down almost all of the drones and missiles, and in a historic shift, at least two Arab nations helped with that. Turnover in election officials has increased, but not as much as feared. Rachel Ori with the Bipartisan Policy Center says more are leaving office, but the trend is slow. She says most folks in those offices still serve for more than 4 years.
So when we see a turnover in a chief election official, it isn't always the case that someone new is coming in who doesn't know what they're doing. Rather, we see more often that it is folks with lots of experience in elections who are stepping into these chief roles.
A New York Times Siena College poll finds views of former President Donald Trump's time in office have grown more favorable over time. This comes even as the former president faces an unprecedented criminal trial starting today. Republican New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu says border security and the economy are simply more important.
People are upset by January 6th. They're upset by the election denial. They have every right to be. I am. But at the end of the day, they need a culture change to get America back on track.
The Tennessee legislature has been sharply divided on gun rights for years, but a bill to let teachers carry concealed weapons in classrooms has just passed that Senate. Democratic State Senator London Lamar calls that extremely dangerous.
Teachers don't want it. The school districts don't want it. Nobody doesn't want it. It's not going to work. It's going to cause more school shootings.
Under the legislation, staff would not have to be trained in de-escalation and parents would not be informed. A quarter of U.S. teachers say their school had a gun lockdown in the past year. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Sarah Wolk from the Equal Vote Coalition about the campaign to use star voting for mayor and city council in Eugene. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. And then at 7, LTAR, Let's Talk About Race. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 44. Tomorrow, those cloudy skies will continue with a high of 56. Today in history, in 1947, Jackie Robinson debuts for the Brooklyn Dodgers, breaking baseball's color line. And the quote of the day is from a renowned Italian doodler and tinkerer, Leonardo da Vinci, born this day in 1452. He said, quote, "Learning acquired in youth arrests the evil of old age. And if you understand that old age has wisdom for its food, you will so conduct yourself in youth that your old age will not lack for nourishment."
Last week was the annual Arctic Encounter Symposium, and Alaska Native mothers are raising concerns about deteriorating conditions in their community. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A group of Alaska Native mothers from the village of Newtok reported on deteriorating conditions in their community at the annual Arctic Encounter Symposium in Anchorage last week. As Emily Schwing reports, climate change means the permafrost under the Alaska Native community is deteriorating and causing severe erosion. The village has been trying to relocate for more than three decades.
The five women took to the stage barefoot in solidarity for their friends and family members who live in Newtok. For many years, the village has been working with several state and federal agencies to relocate the entire community, nearly 400 people, to hire more stable ground at Mahtakvik. It's 9 miles across the Ninglik River. Carolyn George is a Newtok Village Council member.
And, you know, there is no blueprint on how to do this relocation. You know, relocating the whole community to a whole different place, and we did not know how to do it, and it's been taking too long.
There are nearly 150 rural communities in Alaska considering partial and full relocations due to climate change-driven environmental disasters. Jackie Schaefer is the director of climate initiatives at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. She's been working with Newtok for years. Schaefer says lessons from Newtok and Mahtavik can inform those future projects.
And really, this just shows this is just one community of many that will need to be relocated in the state of Alaska. And if we can't figure it out for a community of under 400 people, there's no way when we hit Louisiana, LA, and all the other lower 48 communities that we're going to be able to figure it out.
In the meantime, Schaefer told the audience the mothers of Newtok are an inspiration. They're going to adapt, she said. In Anchorage, I'm Emily Schwing.
A formal process begins this week in Anchorage to document Native boarding school abuse. The project is under the U.S. Interior Department's Federal Boarding School Initiative. The National Native Boarding School Healing Coalition will conduct 3 days of interviews. The session begins with opening ceremonies Monday at the Alaska Native Heritage Center. 40 acres near Bear Butte have been purchased by an indigenous-led organization in the hopes of teaching the next generation of traditional values and land stewardship. The group's leader says it's also a chance to reclaim a piece of what was stolen after colonization. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's CJ Keene has more.
The Cheyenne River Youth Project has purchased the Black Hills land adjacent to a culturally significant site, Bear Butte. Group CEO Julie Garrow says when reservations are hours from these important places, it becomes a matter of access.
The Black Hills and those sacred sites are extremely important to connection to Lakota people. So being able to access them is critical in terms of raising healthy young Lakota children.
More than that, though, Garrow says reclaiming this space after over a century of broken treaty obligations stirs deep emotion.
The Supreme Court already said that land is ours. They wanted to pay for it, and we won't accept it. Is it unfair that we had to buy it? Yeah, it is. But we did what we had to do because the kids that we work with are so important.
In turn, Garrow says they can deepen the well of cultural programming they offer.
We want to teach kids about what the land can offer them in terms of food, medicinal plants. I think a lot of people refer to, you know, even just the plains as, you know, food deserts. And, you know, I really don't believe that that's what that is. I think we have a lot of our traditional foods. We just can't access them because we don't have access to the land like we used to.
The land dedication ceremony will be held in private at the end of the month. I'm CJ Keene in Rapid City.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Reproductive health advocates say that ease of access to contraception could lower accidental pregnancies. According to Indiana Department of Health, of the almost 9,600 pregnancies that were terminated in 2022, nearly 67% of abortions occurred within 4 to 8 weeks of conception. Three groups are working to make access to birth control easier to reduce unwanted pregnancies. Terry D. has more in Indianapolis.
Vending machines commonly found in workplace break rooms generally contain soft drinks or snacks. But one machine in Indianapolis dispenses unconventional items at the turn of a knob. The Plan B morning after pill, pregnancy test, and condoms are displayed in a clear glass case inside a colorful blue and orange dispenser. These items provide easy access to protection against an unwanted pregnancy and are free of charge. Melissa Groover with the feminist organization Indiana Task Force says it operates like a traditional vending machine.
Then you just push whatever you want. It falls down and you reach your hand in through the little door and you pull it out. Take it with you.
The 2022 Indiana Department of Health termination report indicates 9,600 pregnancies were aborted, with Marion County recording the highest number of unwanted pregnancies. The report also notes that the average age a woman in Indiana who sought an abortion was 27, and 67% of all terminated pregnancies occurred within 4 to 8 weeks of conception. The state's contentious near-total abortion ban, which was upheld by the Indiana Supreme Court last year, has stoked fears that lawmakers may begin restricting a woman's choice of birth control. Indiana Task Force and reproductive health groups All Options and the Midwest Access Coalition want the emergency contraceptive vending machine to serve as a gathering spot for community conversations on reproductive rights and sexual health.
We've long been organizing in our communities to bring about reproductive justice, which we didn't have before, and we definitely don't have it now. But what we know to be true is that there are more of us that want access to reproductive care than those that try to stop it. We're excited to continue to work to meet this need now and to organize for a better community.
Groover hopes to have one dispenser in every Indiana region in the future to add to the single machine that currently sits inside an Eastside Indianapolis grocery store. She says some universities statewide already have vending machines offering similar contraception products, but users have to purchase those items. This story is based on original reporting by Mary Claire Malloy for Mirror Indy. I'm Terry D. reporting.
A recent report finds nearly 25 million black and brown voters are missing from commonly used databases across the country. Mark Richardson reports from Ohio.
Census data indicates that among voting-age Americans, nearly 25 million black and brown eligible voters are missing from commonly used registration databases. A recent study by McKinney Gray Analytics finds that people of color are being systematically sidelined by seemingly inclusive, data-driven digital systems of voter engagement. Analysts say that could eliminate thousands of key voters in states such as Ohio. In 2023, Ohio eliminated almost 26,000 names from its voting rolls. Prentice Haney with the nonprofit Ohio Organizing Collaborative says that often means many eligible voters must re-register or be disenfranchised.
Over time, they actually fall off the list and they're not even in the conversation. And what we see in America is that those voters tend to be black voters and brown voters and people of color. And it's not because those voters are disengaged, it's that they're cynical about the system.
The Ohio Secretary of State eliminated more than 26,000 names from the state's voting list for lack of voting activity for the previous 4 years. Haney says many of the people on the list have moved and did not receive a notice. State has a website where voters can check their status and re-register if they've been purged. The study says that given how close recent elections have been, finding and engaging these millions of missing black and Latino voters will almost certainly determine the outcome of elections in the future. Haney says many of the omitted voters are lost in the system.
When we say a voter is missing, what we mean is that in the ways that traditional campaigns do outreach, these voters are not on those lists. They are not being targeted. They are missing from engagement and the outreach that they should get as someone engaging in our democracy.
Deidre Reese is the Collaborative's voter engagement director. She says it's important for people purged from the rolls to understand that their vote counts.
Certainly it can be challenging because there are people who feel like it doesn't matter, but we try to help them understand why it does matter when they are engaged, but also that when they disengage, that it can matter more because you have a smaller number of people who are driving the process.
This story was produced in association with Media in the Public Interest and funded in part by the George Gund Foundation. For Ohio News Connection, I'm Mark Richardson.
Governor Tina Kotek's office has lost its fourth staffer in less than a month. This after Lindsay Burrows announced her resignation last Monday. Burrows is the current deputy general counsel for Kotek. She will depart on April 26th and return to work as a criminal defense attorney. Burrows joins Chief of Staff Andrea Cooper, Special Advisor Abby Tibbs, and Deputy Chief of Staff of Public Engagement Lindsay O'Brien. Cooper, Tibbs, and O'Brien announced their departures in late March. Sources say the recent departures of senior staff result from the expanded role of First Lady Amy Kotek Wilson in the governor's office. Kotek herself has not discussed the reasons for their departures, but has not contradicted the link. It's unclear, however, whether Burrow's departure is connected to the First Lady. Significantly, unlike her departing colleagues, Burrows presented a resignation letter to Kotek's office. While governors experience staff turnover, observers note the sheer amount of departures over a short period is abnormal. Kotek Wilson is exploring the creation of an Office of the First Spouse. Office-holding first spouses are not unprecedented nationwide. In Oregon, however, the only precedent remains the role given to First Lady Sylvia Hayes in the Kitzhaber administration. This eventually led to John Kitzhaber's resignation. Speaking with reporters at the beginning of April, Governor Kotek described the recent slate of departures, with echoes of Tom Jones, as, quote, not unusual.
President Biden approves federal support for ice storm recovery in Portland. On Saturday, Biden approved a major disaster declaration request made by Governor Tina Kotek to help the state recover from deadly winter weather the state experienced in January. A preliminary damage assessment put the toll at over $48 million. The severe winter weather led to 17 deaths and caused over 230,000 residents to lose power, some for as long as 2 weeks. 1,300 small businesses had severe financial losses from the storm, too. Biden's declaration means that Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, will provide supplemental grants to state, tribal, and local governments for recovery. It's a reimbursement program with federal monies covering 75% of costs. Governor Kotek said, quote, I am grateful to President Biden for answering our call for help following the January ice and wind emergency, and to our federal delegation for amplifying this critical need. This opportunity for federal assistance will make a significant difference across communities that are still grappling with significant damage from the storm, end quote.
The first set of bills based on recommendations from the California Reparations Task Force is winding its way through the legislature, and a key bill on eminent domain has a hearing on Tuesday. Suzanne Potter has more on the story.
A hearing is set for tomorrow in Sacramento on a key bill recommended by the California Reparations Task Force. The state Senate Judiciary Committee will consider SB 1050, which would reimburse people or their descendants who lost property to racially motivated eminent domain without fair compensation. Bill co-author, State Senator Stephen Bradford, says this is a first step toward redressing historical injustices that disproportionately impacted black people.
This is a real stain on America, the sin of slavery. Most people don't even understand that most of the wealth in this country is dependent on 400 years of free labor. We still have a racist core in America.
The bill is part of a package of 14 bills supported by the California Legislative Black Caucus to address many issues, including homeownership, property tax relief in redlined communities, and a formal apology from Governor Gavin Newsom for California's history of anti-black racism. Mandela Kaisi is an educational and community planning consultant and a member of the City of Los Angeles Reparations Advisory Commission.
There's a large majority of black folks who favor reparations. The skepticism is whether or not any government body will actually deliver. You know, we've never had a moment in our history where reparations was taken up as seriously as it has been in the current era.
The LA Commission is still in its information gathering process and expects to release its recommendations by December. None of the bills currently proposed calls for direct cash payments to descendants of slaves. Advocates note, however, that the U.S. has paid reparations before to Japanese Americans imprisoned in internment camps during World War II. This story was produced with original reporting from Aaron Aubrey Kaplan for Yes Magazine. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 15th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Reed Johnson. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Birdie. Special thanks to Eric Tegdoff, Suzanne Potter, Catherine Carley, Terry D., Antonia Gonzalez, and Mark Richardson. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of the newscast is available at our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath,